I will call the meeting to order, and Representative Biskins, would you like to move the minutes? Representative Biskins moves the minutes of January 21st. Any discussion? All in favor? Is there a quorum? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. And members, today we are fortunate to have something that we did 2 years ago at the beginning of session, and we liked it so well that we invited back the University of Minnesota Department of College of Education and Human Development, because we all know that at the beginning of session we like to think big and we have big ideas. And I'd like actually to have them be backed up by something more than just what legislators might be able to come up with. And the University of Minnesota is such a wealth and such a diamond for us here in our state that we know we don't take enough time to take advantage of. And so we like to start out, at least when we're in January, with familiarizing ourselves with the resources that we do have available. And in our new Minnesota Miracle, we have innovation revenue. We talked about it when growth and justice was here. Having schools that aren't making enough progress do things that actually work and that are based on research and evidence. And so the university is one of our fine places where we can get that sort of information. So we're going to start out with Dr. David Johnson, who's the Senior Associate Dean for Research and Policy, and he will give us an overview of the department at the university. And then we have himself and four other very talented university professors who will talk about specific topics. Each one is going to talk for 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. And then we'll have that amount of time with each one to ask questions, and we'll finish up then at our usual time, having heard from all of them. So, Dr. Johnson, welcome, and again, please state your name and title for our tape.
I certainly will. Representative Riling, members of the committee, my name is David Johnson. I am the Senior Associate Dean for Policy and Research and Policy in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. It's a lot to say in one sentence. On behalf of our college and my colleagues who are here today, as well as Interim Dean Quam, we are here really to provide you with an opportunity to look at a sample of research from the university. This research has been undertaken, and you'll see how it's being undertaken here, in partnership with our communities, our schools, our agencies as well. So you see that this is really kind of the research with full engagement in trying to work with our schools to take a look at ways to improve practice and student performance. We have a series of 5 short presentations, and we'll limit the time of each of our presenters to 7 minutes. You have the PowerPoint, I believe, in front of you in paper form. We will, at the close of each of these short vignettes, I guess we would call them, provide an opportunity for a few questions, and then we'll move on to perhaps have some time at the end of this to, as well, talk a little bit further. Please realize that this is a very small sampling of what we do, and I think by way of what I'd like to do here is to, in some ways, introduce you to a new College of Education and Human Development, or reintroduce you to that college a little bit by providing to you some information about kind of the size, scope, and true capacity of research, as well as teaching and engagement that exists within this particular part of the university. You all know that the University of Minnesota is a land-grant institution and ranks as the highest divisional standing for research. It's called an R1. This is a distinction which is not common to all universities, but to a few that have stature that generate in excess of $40 million a year. And extramural funding, the University of Minnesota overall generates about $650 million in extramural funding for research, for enterprise development, for teaching and other professional activities. We have chosen, and I think this has been kind of a smart thing for us to do, is to try to frame a way in which our research can be translated very quickly into bit more accessible and friendly to the public. Driven for Discovery, you've seen it on television. The College of Education Human Development is the group. Now watch for this commercial, please. It's the one where Aaron Daring is in the Arctic, televising in or satelliting in kind of climate change information to classrooms throughout the world with over 3 million children across the planet participating in this particular event. This was funded by National Geographic, NASA, and the Best Buy Children's Fund. We are a new college from the standpoint of 2 years is a very new, very limited or short period of time. Under the strategic positioning of President Brunings and the Board of Regents, we closed General College, we closed the College of Human Ecology, and the College of Education and Human Development partnered in this by incorporating into our college the entirety of General College and the programs of the School of Social Work and the Department of Family Social Sciences. This enlarged our college significantly. We grew by 40% overnight. This was effective July 1, 2006. We are now the third largest college at the University of Minnesota. Nationally, I just want to make sure we understand these things too. We're ranked 17th among all professional schools of education. This includes Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and the rest. We're ranked 11th among all public professional schools of education, including all Big Ten, Big Eight, and the rest. We're ranked third nationally by one study out of Florida in research among all public colleges of education in the United States.
Congratulations.
We feel good. Okay. The research capacity here in terms of there's 260 professionals directly involved in the research enterprise in the college. These include 185 faculty and 75 professionals who are really academic researchers, we call them, mostly at the doctoral level. Approximately 690 other staff support this college in terms of providing infrastructure, technology, communications, other things. The college is big as some universities. There's 5,374 full and part-time students participating in 57 undergraduate and graduate degree programs at the full-scaling level of BA to PhD. The college also secures approximately $30 million annually in sponsored research from the United States Department of Education, National Institute of Health, National Science Foundation. We have over in the institute that I direct also, we have over 35 funding sources concurrently running. We work with foundations, federal agencies, state agencies, school districts, and communities as well. We operate all of this out of 9 academic departments, 4 major college-wide centers, one of which we will present today a little bit about their research. And we also have, in addition to that, 30 additional centers that are positioned within departments and research labs. Now, if that's confusing, see me later. I'll explain it. Areas of scholarship and research are diverse. What you see here, and I've said it before, is a very small sampling of what we do. These are just a few of the areas in which we have studies now undergoing. In the institute that I do direct, the Institute on Communication, we have concurrently running 40 studies each and every day from all over the United States and even internationally. We span the globe in terms of this research. We are working with schools, you will see, on the north side of Minneapolis, by undertaking very comprehensive long-term research programs. 2 researches being conducted on educational issues and even disability and special education types of issues in Zambia, in places like Kyrgyzstan, the Czech Republic, Thailand, Vietnam, Korea, all over the globe. So this is just a little sampling, a little PR boast, I guess, I don't know. But I just thought I would at least give you a little familiarity with the college itself. I'm not sure if you wish to take questions at the end of that one, or let's move to the research maybe, or...
Are there any questions? We'll go to the research.
Okay, very good. It's my pleasure now to introduce our first researcher, Jennifer McCombs.
Welcome, Dr. McCombs. And again, you have to restate your name for our tape and tell us your title.
Representative Greiling and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. I am Jennifer McComas from the Department of Educational Psychology in the College of Education and Human Development.
And members, we do have bios in our packet too if you want to look at that. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll begin with some sobering statistics. Less than one quarter of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch, and less than half of other students, achieved grade level proficiency in reading in 2005. The consequences of not being proficient readers at fourth grade are dire. Individuals who are not proficient readers by fourth grade go on to experience poor post-secondary outcomes, including difficulties gaining and sustaining employment and incarceration. Here in the Twin Cities, one of the strong correlates with our dismal high school graduation rates is poor reading proficiency. It is important to recognize that not all students learn the same way, and so therefore should probably not all be taught the same way. Theoretically, roughly 80% of students should be responsive or successful with the universal or day-to-day sorts of instruction that is provided in the classroom by the classroom teacher. A portion of those students, between 10 and 15%, are only somewhat successful with that kind of instruction, but benefit from supplemental targeted instruction. That might include some things like small group instruction, some focused attention on particular academic areas, or those kinds of things. Finally, 3 to 5% of students are not even successful with that kind of targeted instruction, and they actually really require some individualized instruction. Lacking in our schools currently is support for formative assessment of student performance, data management, and analysis to identify exactly which students are not being successful given universal instruction and which are in need of supplemental targeted or individualized instruction. So the problem is really twofold. There's a large proportion of students who are not proficient readers. The second is there is a lack of infrastructure and support for schools to identify and intervene with students who are struggling to be proficient in the area of reading. Here's an example of the effects of an individualized intervention program that we've conducted with sixth graders at an elementary school in North Minneapolis. Now, I'll take you through the results in a slide or two, but right now what I'd like to draw your attention to is the vertical axis, where it says words read correctly per minute. That is an index of reading fluency that is often used to characterize how students are doing with regard to reading proficiency. The dashed line indicates average students' reading fluency in sixth grade. An average student who's proficient at reading is that dashed line. At the beginning of the school year in fall, they start reading at about 125 or so words per minute. The two lines below that start, one of them starts at about 115 words per minute, and the other one starts at about 92 words per minute. Those two lines represent the students at Lucy Laney in sixth grade. That's 50% of the students in the sixth grade at Lucy Laney, and they are clearly beginning the school year below where we would expect the average student nationally to be beginning as a reader, a fluent reader, or a proficient reader in sixth grade. The reading program that I'm conducting uses a prescriptive assessment approach to identifying an effective individualized intervention for each individual student. Here's an example of a girl. Her name is Nyla, and she is a sixth grader. What we do is we test two or more different individualized instructional strategies for each student to identify which strategies are most effective for that student. With Nyla and with most students, we test approximately two per day, and it takes about half an hour to test two strategies. So this analysis, these data you're looking at, these six data points, was conducted in a total of 3 days, three half-hour sessions. For Nyla, you can see that in a short period of time, there's a clear difference in reading fluency between the two conditions that we tested, the fluency contingency and listen sentence preview. Each student, we get different results because it's individualized. We do this kind of prescriptive assessment with each student to identify the intervention that's most effective for them. And then we implement the most effective intervention for each student 3 times per week for 30 minutes per day. I should note that all of these, the study that I'm showing you now and all of the tutoring sessions, the 30-minute periods of individualized instruction, were conducted by University of Minnesota graduate students. So here are those results again, and I'll take you through. That dashed line, each of these lines represents growth, student growth on average for the groups from fall to spring in reading fluency. Nationally, students grow according to this dashed line. They start at around 128 or so words per minute and end around 150 words per minute. The sixth graders who did not participate in our project, the control group, is the line that ends at, that says 136.78 words per minute. What you can see there is that those sixth graders started below where average sixth graders across the country start, but their growth is parallel. Their sixth grade teacher did her job, and they made a year's growth within a year, but they started lower than the average students in the country, and they ended lower than the average student in the country. The third line that begins down just above 90 and ends up at over 154 words per minute is the group who participated in our program. And this represents growth from approximately 90 words per minute for each student to over 154 words per minute. This program ran from November through May, and these data suggest that this is a promising way to make meaningful gains in students' academic growth and perhaps even to begin to close the achievement gap. I just want to take a few seconds to mention two approaches to these problems that I discussed that are not working. The first is relying solely on annual high-stakes tests to evaluate student and teacher performance. We need formative assessments that can aid in identifying individual students who are in need and prescribe the level and type of intervention that each student needs. The second approach that is not effective, has not been working, is providing supplemental supports for academics during elective after-school programs. Those types of programs tend to lack expertise of staff, the attendance of students, and the commitment of families. So in closing, what I believe these data suggest is that needed a support for schools for supplemental individualized instruction.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ward, Representative Ward. I'm thinking of doctors today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. McComas, as I looked at your bio, I saw that you were have a very vast background and knowledge of EDD. Are you relating the reading situation to EDD? Number one, I have two different questions. So just can you relate to that first, please, before I go to my second question?
Dr. McComas.
Thank you, Representatives and Representative Dreiling. The reason I got into this initially was because as I was supervising student teachers and that kind of thing in classrooms, I would see the affect and the light in children as young as first and second grade really dimming over the course of a school year, and children really developing behavior problems and not having the same kind of enthusiasm that you typically see in children about school and about learning and those kinds of things. And it, in talking with some officials from the district, there is a correlation between students who are having academic difficulties and behavior difficulties. That correlation is strong, and we've known that. And particularly in the district, with children who have not been academically successful, behavior problems follow. And it's one of those issues that include incarceration. So indeed, part of the promise of this is to prevent behavior problems by addressing academics and helping students to be successful academically.
Madam Chair, follow up, please.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. McComas, I totally agree with that. I worked in the field for about 30 some years, and response to intervention is huge, early intervention especially. Last year, we had a bill in K-12 policy, Representative Mariani probably remembers this, dealing with reading and reading programs. You talked about the program that you used at the University of Minnesota, the specific reading program. Can you tell us who that program is tailored after, formatted after, and what are other programs that you're aware of because we have quite a dialogue about, and Representative Mariani, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we have quite a dialogue about the different kinds of programs, the different kind of strategies, and the different kind of interventions being created.
Dr. McComas.
Thank you very much, Representative Ward, is it, and Representative Dreiling. My area of expertise and the work that we've been doing has really been in that very top triangle, that individualized intervention. So I can't really speak to the kinds of universal instruction or targeted instruction, reading first, or those kinds of programs that are being used or are effective with students. The program that we're running is not actually a commercial program or a program. It's not a reading program per se. It's more of a prescriptive assessment for identifying effective interventions, and it really is based on hypotheses about why a student might not be successful. For example, they may not have had enough practice. In North Minneapolis in particular, we have a very high homeless and highly mobile population, and if they've been moving from school to school, there may be gaps in their practice of particular skills related to reading. Another hypothesis might be that they're not motivated to do it, and so an incentive might be effective. So it's more of a hypothesis testing approach than it is testing any particular reading program. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Yes. Is it geared after Barbara Taylor's model?
But it
isn't geared after any one model. It's geared after. Go ahead.
Dr. McComas.
Thank you. I would say that it is complementary to Dr. Taylor's program. Her approaches are more at the universal and targeted levels, and then mine will be at the top there.
And I think that we're all interested in that reading question, because we had such a tussle with the Senate, those who were following that at the end of session last year. And so, and I noticed you talked about the RTI, and there are some that say that, you know, having more reading instruction that includes more phonics for all teachers is part two to the RTI. And I wonder, maybe even Dr. Johnson, or is there anyone, or would Dr. McComas be the right one to tell us if you think that is borne out or not by the research at the U? Dr. Johnson.
Yeah, Representative Lang. I think what we'd like to do here, certainly the research that Barbara Taylor, Professor Taylor, has undertaken has been certainly recognized as part of the Reading First program here, but kind of the core of that. I'm not sure I'm answering this question for you. I think what we'd like to do, too, is just really be open and extend to you the opportunity to provide you with more information from our side as to what works. Jennifer laid it out here, is a very, kids learn in different ways, okay, and they learn reading in different ways. Therefore, you need an array of strategies. This isn't about phonics or whole language or whatever. It's about the tools in the box. What do we need to address these particular types of needs? And of what we're using or what we put in the box, what do we know about this that really works and that we can hold to as being effective practice? I mean, that's what we're trying to get at here. So there are a variety of strategies that we have researched, worked on. Some are very profoundly known nationally, and some are emerging. And what Dr. McComas is speaking to here, too, is the need to, at that very high need level, begin to think about individualization in the modalities that work for these kids such that they can show gains like this. It's part of closing the gap. And if that's okay, I can work with you. I got Richard Watson here who will work with us also.
Yes, and Mr. Watson is at all of our meetings, and we thank him for his role in helping to arrange these talented people. And I think, Representative Ward, your question brings up that not only do we have the people here and what they're presenting and answering questions about, but we can always continue to go back to the university, and that is what why we're having this meeting, so all members can know that this is an incredible resource, and we value your neutral, non-political, research-based answers that we can get from you. Often we get caught up in trying to do the best thing, but we get so emotionally attached to what we're for that we just forget about the research if it's something that's our bill. And so that's what you are here for, and we value that. And Dr. McComas, did you want to add anything?
Yes, thank you very much. One of the things that I think is particularly valuable about the RTI model itself, and there are different ways that you can talk about it, and you don't even have to call it an RTI model, but a way of really looking at individual student data and collecting formative assessment data throughout the school year to be able to identify those students who are not being successful with whatever curriculum is being implemented or whatever program is being implemented, so that instructional planning can be adjusted accordingly and continue monitoring that student's progress as instructional practice is modified even slightly for that individual student.
And since no one, we do have another one. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, do you, as a part of your research, or this question maybe even be to the chair, do we have records somewhere of state participation in this type of a program right now, as far as the schools, you know, throughout the state of Minnesota who might be participating or not?
Dr. McCormick.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. There are data, through the Minnesota, the state RTI network, I believe it's called, and that group has been doing a lot of work training and coaching and supporting and working towards sustainability of RTI models across the state. So there are those data. Is that what you were asking about RTI in particular?
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, just off the top of your head, do you know of the certain schools that might be using this research to the benefit of students right now?
Dr. McCormick.
Thank you. I do not know how many, but I can certainly get back to you with those data.
One last question, I guess, and I'll ask it. We had a question yesterday from Representative Tilbury when we were dealing with the Department of Education. We were always wondering if we were doing too much testing, too much summative testing. I think you mentioned that's not doing as much good as one might hope. And then the question was, is there any way to combine or embed the formative data through the NWEA MAP testing so that it could be less testing time for students, but yet they could both work with the overlap? Have you any knowledge if that could work or not? We hear from some that it could work and then others that logistically it would never work. What could you tell us?
Thank you. My opinion, where there's a will, there's a way.
Thank you. Well, that represents Tilbury.
And there are examples also.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. Well, there are legislators working on that legislation. I think Representative Tilbury is one of them. Did you write down that name? You did. Okay, good. I think we're at the end of the time. Thank you, Dr. McComas, so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Johnson.
Yes. I'd like to now ask Dr. Tyler Wallstrom to come. Can I address you?
Welcome, Dr. Wallstrom.
Thank you.
You could restate your name and title for the tape.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Representative Greiling, members of the committee. My name is Kyla Wallstrom. I'm the director of the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement, otherwise known as CARI, at the University of Minnesota in the College of Education and Human Development. I have many slides to share with you, and I'm not going to go through every bullet point, but I'm just going to hit the highlights, and then you can read for yourself how the information might supplement what you want to know more about. You can see that on the first slide, our research focus, or foci, are in two areas. We do policy research that has practical or realistic implications and outcomes. We do studies of leadership and professional development. And we also do studies in curriculum and instruction looking at best practices. In other words, my elevator speech for our work is, with anything that is new that's happening in education, we investigate it. That's if we're asked. And so we are pretty much up on what are the newest things happening in the field. We've been around for about 20 years now. It's pretty amazing that we're at our 20-year point. And we've done over 250 studies in those 20 years. Just some examples of the 250 that you probably have heard of, some more than others. In the policy research area, we've done the big study on definitive study, later starting times for high school, block scheduling, which is the staff across the nation. We've done the longitudinal study of outcomes for all day K. Examples of the leadership professional development, we did the evaluation of two comp pilot for MDE. We are at the end of a five-year national research study funded by the Wallace Foundation, largest study ever done in the United States, looking at the effect of educational leadership on student achievement. And we are also looking quite a bit into technology, for instance, the one-to-one laptop program for teacher professional development and student outcomes. In curriculum instruction, we look at strategies and practices such as the effect of arts-integrated curriculum in schools, Minneapolis Public Schools, by the way, is now been awarded an enormous grant to do more work with integrating arts into their day-to-day curriculum. We look at math outcomes for math education using grade-level mentors. We've looked at impact of literacy programs for at-risk preschoolers and on and on. Just a little example of the kind of things we do find. We look at policy. The later starting time for high schools, this has been a study that began in 96, and it is interesting to the United States as it was in 96 and 98. It began in Edina in Minneapolis. I was contacted by the superintendents. They wanted us to do a neutral evaluation of whether or not this was working. And if it wasn't working, then they would change and go back to their old way. We found significant findings, and we did a five-year longitudinal follow-up to see if the findings were being maintained. As you can see, there's statistically significant more students staying in school in high school in Minneapolis. That is a huge finding for Minneapolis public schools. Honestly, the number of kids that are staying, we call it continuously enrolled, is so significant after the change in time that they would never choose to go back. There's significantly fewer students reporting depression, nurses, counselors, and principals saying that less problems in the school tenor, and students themselves report getting better grades. They feel more efficacious to get their work done. This has absolutely fueled a national policy agenda. What's unique about the study is that it's been a rare blend of new medical information about teen neurological development with educational policy. It's rare that you find direct connections between the medical world and education. And since 1998, I've been contacted by between 800 and 1,000 schools and districts in the world, the U.S. Marine Corps, Britain. I mean, it's just everywhere. Findings and policy is just related to how this gets done. We've been seen as a national leader, and I've been contacted by virtually every national news organization, Congressional Record, Rolling Stone magazine, Time magazine, ABC, NBC News, the works. It's been a fun ride. Okay, here's the information that we have about the Q Comp thing. Again, we are a neutral, rigorous research organization, and you can see, I'm not going to read all the bullets that we found about Q Comp, but it's very instructive for the schools that were considering to adopt Q Comp. Because if what we found is followed, or were being followed at the time that other schools were enrolling in the alternative teacher pay program, HETPS, or QCOMP, you can see that there's some things that really must be in place. And I think it's important that that third bullet, rewards based only on student achievement, are inequitable. There's a real view of districts that have a high mobile, very needs-based kids.
Should you send that over to the governor?
Well, the governor's people have seen this.
Okay.
So that's the Q Comp. You can see there's a lot of information there. Here's a little example about the curriculum instruction. Both Wilmington and Richfield paired to look at enrolling their Latino population in a special program for Reading First. We did find reading and math readiness skills significantly improve after 1 year. That's not a really big surprise. I think that we would expect that. Skills, however, were maintained by the children after 3 years as they were completing kindergarten and first grade. So the importance is that we are looking at this longitudinally. And I think that is the one thing that too often happens with research. It's a one-shot, one-year evaluation, and then people go away, and they think that's the answer. And in fact, it's the long-term view of the outcomes, I think, really has the power to tell us what we should be doing differently or better. And you can see that the gains for full-day students were significantly better all along, better than half-day students. On math pairs comparison. All right, so, and I got a call this morning that I should also add a little bit about our all-day kindergarten program. I need to tell you that we are at the end of our fifth year study with the Burnsville all-day kindergarten. We began studying them when these kids, 800 of them, were all universally enrolled in a preschool program. And it's called Universal Full Day. A couple of quick slides. You can see that in the first and second beginning, now these kids are now in fourth grade. And so you can see that there were some real changes based on the yellow line, the top line, is the universal full day cohort. That's from when they were kindergartners in 03, 04. There is a fee-based, after 1 year, they had to go to a fee-based program. So Burnsville then in 04, 05 bifurcated their program into fee-based full day and free half day. Well, you can see already there were real differences that were happening between the half and full day groups.
if you look at their ELL, the ELL status question, we can see that the all full-day kids from 03-04 and 04-05, the green line, are significantly doing better than the half-day students based on the Gates Beginnity test. We looked also at racial issues, the white and the children of color, and we basically can see now we have some third grade data coming in from their fall scores, and they in fact are significantly better. Now it's interesting to look at that line, and the gap is there, but the gap is getting smaller. And we will be sharing our final year's information with the Burnsville School Board in about a month, and I'd be happy to share with you after that month. It is protocol we would share with the school board first before we would make it public anyplace else. But the school board will see that, and then I'll be happy to bring that information back to you in another, say, month or 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, questions?
All right, Amber's question. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that as you talked about the gap getting smaller, I noticed that the it's smaller because the white students, it looks like accelerated and then fell back. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, you are.
Okay, and so can you tell what the reason for that was, or do you know what the outcome of that was?
Madam Chair, Representative, I suspect, though, when we will find this to be verified or not by our last round of data, since we have the MCA data for the students that are going to be that are now in fourth grade, there is something that seems to be happening with regard to the students who stay continuously enrolled and aren't mobile. So the white kids that are moving around are not doing as well even as the non-white children who are staying. We'll get that verified, but that's a suspicion that we think is happening.
Representative Garofalo, followed by Representative Ansel. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. On page 10 of the presentation, it's our page 10, I don't know if it comes up with yours. So consider incentives, both carrots and sticks, to promote and sustain teacher participation over the first 3 years. Are there any suggestions of carrots or sticks?
Dr. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Representative. when we were interviewing teachers from all over the state who were involved in the pilot program for TCOMP, obviously the carrots had to do with incentives to provide maybe more money for professional development for teachers. That would be one of the carrots. I think that also having district discussions about how they restructure the time that the teachers would be allowed for teacher meetings. It may mean that there'd be an extra day perhaps supported in August or maybe before or after the school year, so there'd be more time for teachers to meet and discuss. That would be a carrot. The sticks that were there would be if districts put in an application and then didn't follow through with what they said they were going to do, that there would be some kind of recrimination is a strong word, but there would be something that would be saying, wait a minute, you took the money but you didn't follow through with what you said you were going to do. So it's not a matter of oversight as much as that people need to be fairly visited with what they are in fact doing, and not just telling. Because one of the things that our study did is we were out there in the schools, we were talking to people, and we were observing. Because it's one thing for people to self-report what they're doing, but it's another for us to be visiting and then seeing whether or not things are happening as they had described them to be happening.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So like an accountability mechanism, it's my words, not yours, but a penalty. If you don't do what you say you're going to do, mm-hmm. we do something you don't want us to do to you, right? Okay. Second point in the same slide, it says rewards based on only student achievement are inequitable. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that point?
Well, that
That's
does.
Awesome.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative. That does go to the fact that Minneapolis was a QComp pilot. There were some schools that were part of the TAP program, that were part of the QComp program.
And they really felt that there were some things that they were really trying hard to accomplish and did accomplish that then if they were only measured on student achievement as to whether or not they're then their teachers pay. Each district can decide how the teachers, it's sort of a menu. So some districts say, well, you'll automatically get the $2,500 bonus if you do X, Y, and Z. Others say, well, if your school, your students, rather, achieve a certain level, then you get $500 per teacher, and if you get a, your students get a this level, then you get $1,000. So those kinds of discrepancies were really felt to be inequitable because depending on the population of students the teachers were teaching, it was really quite quite discrepant or different from one district to another in terms of how teachers were supported.
Madam Chair, I'm here to follow up. So from this perspective, if I offer a hypothetical, we've got two classrooms. One classroom has got 90% of the kids from middle-income families, two-parent families, and then you've got another classroom that's 90% single-parent families, free and reduced lunch programs. This would say that this point would be that it's not fair to say the test scores in both classes should be the same.
Dr. Walston. Madam Chair, Representative, that's an important question that you're asking, because you're asking about the score.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it isn't about necessarily the score, but what the district has set as the criterion for teachers to achieve the extra pay. And not all districts tied it to student achievement. Some districts tied it only to teachers saying that they participated in X number of professional development sessions and other things that were not tied necessarily to student performance.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And that was the debate here. That was originally part of what was proposed. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My colleagues on the committee won't be surprised, but my question is also about QCOM. And with disclosure, I do have a district that is in QCOM. I'm guessing that at some point in time during this session of the legislature, this committee is going to have to make some decisions, and QCOM is going to be one of them. My question is, are you courageous enough to give us a little snapshot in terms of how you would evaluate funding QCOM in relationship to all of the other funding decisions, large and small, that we're going to have to make on the continuum here, understanding that there's 44 districts that are utilizing QCOM today and 250 that are not? Can you give that a shot?
Dr. Walston is courageous. Dr. Walston, Madam Chair, Representative.
You know, yes, I am courageous.
I know you are.
However, I'm also pragmatic. And the thing that is that I think needs to be examined, I would be happy to help you examine that, would be that the pilot program, when we evaluated that was 3 years ago, and there were nine districts in it at the time. So 9 versus 44 is a big difference in terms of what's happening. And I do believe that there's been a lot of improvement and growth in terms of what districts are doing to organize the programs to be effective. So that being said, I think it would be important to look at the data that is now coming forward that might be out there about how things are being measured and assessed. And to that end, that's where the courage might be, would be to critique the assessment and not the program.
And we have two reports coming in, apparently, we found yesterday. We'll get you help with that.
Follow-up comment,
Representative Anzell, and yours is going to be the last comment, okay. And then we go to the next one.
Just to really get to the nub of this, I appreciate rewards based only on students' achievements are inequitable. I appreciate that goal, that statement. But I get confused when we see mixed signals as to what the outcome of QComp is supposed to be. Is it supposed to be an alternative compensation system for teachers, or is it supposed to be a way of improving students' achievement? sometimes those things don't always run in parallel fashion, and I see those objectives sometimes in conflict.
Let's find out if there's any research. Dr. Wallstrom.
Representative and Madam Chair, I do believe that you have hit the nub, because in the districts where they have done a good job of blending those two, it's remarkable. It really is. But where there haven't been conversations about that or really in-depth look, I think it is. It is just sort of like shot in the dark.
Thank you.
Thank you. See how much fun this can be when we check with university people. And unfortunately, we had two more questions, but we are going to go on to, actually, Dr. Johnson is doing the next segment, and Representative Dietrich and Detmer, if you two have questions for the next one, you can be first. Otherwise, if we have time at the end, we can go back. But I want to, last year when we did this, or 2 years ago, we actually didn't get to one person, and another one got a very short time. So we'll stay on schedule as much as we can. Dr. Johnson.
I was finished with introducing myself, I guess, at this point. What I'd like to talk to you about here now is something which is a shared research program at the University of Minnesota. It is Dr. Sandra Christensen, who's been, I think, quite visible in the legislature, both House and Senate, on the report card issue, talked about student engagement measures and things like this. Part of that work comes out of this, what is now called Check and Connect. This program began back in 1990. It is an example of, I think, some of the work we do that does require time to and investments to bring to market, so to speak. And is truly one of the revenue investments or innovations that we're looking at nationally as well. It began with a series of studies out of the Office of Special Education Programs. We're looking at middle school young people with serious emotional disturbances as well as significant learning disabilities with their high rates of dropout. Globally here, we have data that certainly suggests that kids with emotional behavioral disorders on national data, less than half graduate. So we have that problem to confront us here. Estimated, we've now conducted a series of well over a dozen empirical studies all over the state of Minnesota as well as nationally on both students with and without disabilities. So this has become pretty interesting for us to work on. I'm just going to walk you through some things. Yeah, we kind of organize these presentations by bad news, good news. Okay, well, here's the news. I'll just say it's news. This is right off the website for the Minnesota Department of Education. This suggests that there's disparity present in big terms here. This is based on the National Governors Association model or definition of dropout, which simply is follows, cohorts from grade 9 through. This is a huge definitional argument nationally as to what defines dropout, how do we measure dropout, all these things. This is now moving toward a more common kind of definition. The department, I asked them what I could present. Okay, so we are clear about this. Although it's public domain, I just want to make sure I was using the right definition that they wanted me to use here today to reflect on this concern in Minnesota. I'm not going to really tap into this too much. I did not provide national comparative data. We do better than many states. Okay, there are other states who do better than us. And we always have said, well, we're first or second in ACT scores and all these kinds of things. And our graduation rates are among the highest in the nation. Indeed, they are. So what does this suggest about the nation? All right. But you can see it here, significant disparity, and it's statistically significant disparity between measures of all students comparing white nation to black, American Indian, and Hispanic. We have a dilemma. Let me just explain this continuing aspect here. One would expect that under the definitions used here, the students would graduate within 4 years. Many of our students do not exit school in a four-year cycle. They extend. They're held back. They stop out. They come back in. There's many forms of dropping out and many paths, I guess, to graduation here. The unknown factor is we just can't count them any longer. They've disappeared. They've moved out of state. They've gone elsewhere. They're highly mobile students for whom we can't account for. So at least we're accounting for them in a counting process, I guess, at least acknowledging we have this dilemma as well. but those statistics are fairly common. There have been a number of economic studies done, cost-benefit analysis here by Hank Levinot of Teachers College Columbia, and other major studies have come out of the Alliance for Excellent Education, which I've been asked to present to here in the next year, about the cost of dropping out. Yeah, you can look at this in your own time. I think this is really staggering statistics. You know, other things that you find and you read is kind of the factoid. You know, 92% of all incarcerated men are dropouts. Okay? You have these kinds of factors and dilemmas to go on. This is a huge cost to the state, and it's a huge cost to the nation. Check and connect, I'm going to lay it out as simply as I can for myself even sometimes. It really is. It's a process of checking and connecting. Okay? It is really aligned with a major set of theoretical and important principles about student engagement. The fundamental one of which is that students are engaged in their learning, they tend to attend more, okay? They tend to reduce behavioral problems within classrooms, they tend to achieve at higher levels, and they certainly complete school at higher rates. Now that's the concept, and student engagement is kind of embraced around, you know, I mean this is a lot of dialogue we could get into, you know, academic, psychological, behavioral, and cognitive development, and the strategies that kind of rest within those for helping to improve that process of student engaging students with learning. The check part is, and it refers to really a systematic process for assessing students' connection to school, and I'll talk about that in a second here. The connect part means, and Dr. McCormick certainly laid out kind of that three-tiered pyramid you saw there, that there is an array of interventions and strategies we can use, from the most common and basic that may be applied universally to all students to very intensive interventions. And when we're looking at who drops out, we know that those kids, too, do require the full range of interventions that are available within schools. They need access to response to intervention, as well as to have a common culture within the school that helps to engage them and their in their learning. There are four basic components to this model. It starts with a mentor. This is not rocket science, folks. This is what we have known and understood for years. You put an individual who is responsible to a group of 20 students, so a monitor takes on 20 students. What that person does is it monitors things like attendance, class participation, homework, these kinds of things. Make sure the kid is connected to the learning process. Help students think about difficulties that the student may be bringing into the classroom, into the public school environment, in terms of concerns at home, in terms of their own food and nutrition. I mean, those kinds of things. So it helps to really check. It's kind of a holistic kind of checking. And I monitor systematically over time. And really, then, what is the connection part is either through that individual monitor or through a team of educators. Begin to talk about some individualized intervention. What's needed for this young person to more readily or emphatically connect them to what's going on in the school? And then it's really a part of a process, kind of this triangle of home, school, community kinds of connections that we also try to work on. Sometimes these monitors are even going into the home to connect and reconnect kids back into the school context here. Where we have this particular intervention has met the evidence standards of the United States Department of Education and its Institute on Education Sciences. It is now in the What Works Clearinghouse in Washington, D.C. Since we've had a lot of activity around this, there was such interest here in Minnesota for this particular intervention. The Bush Foundation funded a 10-year investment to move Check and Connect into every high school in the city. There's a longitudinal evaluation ongoing there in terms of its impact, and it appears to be quite positive. We have had, literally, in the last year, hundreds of contacts from school districts all over the United States. There's not a state in the nation that is not involved with Check and Connect. We have publications, for example, that we're now marketing out that tell people how to do this process, and we're selling them at $300, $400, $500 at a clip around the country. This is a national problem. Had a call from the Boys and Girls Club of America going out to Atlanta to sit with the national organization. They want to use this as their national high school strategy for graduation. So this is an important model that we think is valid. It has proven, it merits stand on the data that we've looked at here with middle school and high school students in terms of improving attendance, improving social skills ratings and homework completion, enrolled in school and making progress toward state standards, and certainly in demonstrating higher graduation rates. I'm going to stop there and see if there are questions.
Rep. Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Johnson. Hello. Two questions. They're not necessarily related, but they might be. First one, very quickly. The check and connect framework, how is that delivered? Does it involve school counselors? Does it involve community volunteers? Is it a mixture of things? How do we actually deliver it in terms of personnel?
Dr. Johnson.
Representative Browning, Representative Mariani. It varies. What we hold the standard is that there needs to be a relatively small ratio between the monitor and the number of students that are addressed. The way it has worked within the Minneapolis Public Schools, for example, is that this could be a combination of school social workers, high school counselors. It can be the teachers themselves engaged with this. It could be a combination. It could be a team. Well, typically, it's a team of professionals that buy into this. It requires buy-in at the school-wide level, though, so that it is really an opportunity for every educator in that building to become familiar with this process of student engagement and how the monitor works, and that there will be check-ins and connections, different things to think about.
Thank you. Then my other question, going back to page 14 with the race disparity outcomes and graduation rates, I am familiar with these. The last category, that category of unknown, which you identified as we just simply can't find them, That one actually really floors me. And it floors me because I would assume that we would not be able to find the same amount of students, regardless. I can see all the other issues in terms of, you know, what's going on, but not knowing where students are at, I would not expect to see huge fluctuations. And so, we don't know where 4.6% of those white students in that cohort are, but we don't know where 15.6%, you know, so four times, 12% of Latinos and 12% of African Americans. I think there's a wealth of information that this suggests to us about the social dynamic within our schools as a social structure, which I think speaks very strongly to some of the underlying principles of the check and connect approach. Which has everything to do with how, and I would submit or suggest, have everything to do with how we in a society check and connect across races.
Dr. Johnson.
Representative Browning, Representative Moran. You're right. I think this is a very important piece of information that needs to be asked in questions. Why? Or what is it that produces this type of information, this type of data, the levels and rates of these data for individual cultures as well as across cultures? I think that we really don't have good answers there. We can only make assumptions about something like this, that the Hispanic students are likely to be more highly mobile because of poverty issues and other
immigration,
migrant kinds of things, all these things that are stereotypical in our thinking sometimes. We don't have real good answers for this. I am at least impressed that the National Governors Association puts it on the table and says, we have status unknown. You look at I've worked extensively with the U.S. Board of Education on special education data sets, and you see huge categories there in the unknown because we lose a lot of our special education kids because of their transient nature, the way they're shuffled around in terms of schools, school programs, different school districts, and that's very true for kids not just with emotional behavioral disorders, but others who are have other learning disabilities or other forms of even autism, other things like this. Even higher rates appear for special education students in terms of unknown status. And we're just assuming those kids are dropouts. See, that's what was being assumed before. These just happen to be dropouts.
Right.
They're not. They may be disconnected and could be reconnected.
Representative Dietrich gets the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have most recently been very impressed with Growth and Justice and the work that they have done on cost effectiveness of different programs. And you you very clearly state the cost if the cost of if a child drops out. But do you have any information on what is the cost effectiveness of this program?
Dr. Johnson.
Representative Greiling and Representative Peter, we have done a cost analysis of the Check and Connect program. There are the best work right now, and it's readily accessible, is Hank Levin's work out of Teachers College Columbia, which looks at the longer range cost benefit factors that surround dropout and its implications for states. They were recently in Minnesota, and there is a paper I could share with you that talks specifically about the cost benefits and implications of all of this to Minnesota. We have done cost analyses of this, and there's some simple things to think about when you look at this. On average, it costs about $1,300 per pupil to save them to the point of graduation. Okay, that is based on our analyses to date. We know that for every student that is lost by a high school at grade 9, grade 10, accounts for a huge financial blow in terms of overall student enrollment. You start to lose those. You start to say, in Minneapolis or St. Paul or Duluth or wherever, we lose 10-15% of our kids, and with African American and other kids, we're losing even larger numbers. And you start to tag them with the per pupil unit, you're losing. That's where we have to start thinking. What is it that, you know, it costs, but what are we losing if we don't invest in this? That's the issue. Not even the more global, larger economic indicators or workforce indicators in adult life. But even at the current moment, when we lose that population, what happens? You know, and I think we can get, there's a very basic cost parameters and arguments that can be made for the investment is timely and important.
The clarification put $1,300 per student over the high school years?
Per year. I'm sorry.
Per year. Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Johnson. And if you could introduce our fourth guest.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to introduce Dr. K. Wall.
Welcome, Dr. Wall. And if you could restate your name for the tape and your title.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. K. Herding Wall, and I am the from the Educational Psychology Department in the Counseling Student Personnel Psychology Program. I am the Clinical Training Director for the Master's part of the Counseling Program, and I'm also the School Counseling Director in that program. And so I'm quite excited to talk to you because so many of the issues that are coming up, I have all the answers. They're the school counselors.
Representative Tilbury just verified that.
Yeah, I thought he might, but you know, it's quite exciting because we are the kind of people who could be the mentors. But what you don't often hear the words counseling, and particularly school counseling, and data research in the same sentence. Part of the reason for that is that it's difficult to do research on counseling issues because they're emotional things and they're things that are difficult to quantify. And so school counselors in the past few years have become more aware of the need to be accountable and to provide evidence of our effectiveness and the effectiveness of our programs. And because of that, probably, I have become involved in four different grants where in a partnership with the university in my program with programs that go into the public schools. And so we're using some of it as federal money, some of it is local money, with local grants. And that's the research that you're seeing in the slides that I'm going to talk about. But we're trying to show the effectiveness and the need for school counseling programs within the schools to show the difference that it makes in how students perform. And the three areas that our programs go into are academics, career, and personal social. Because we definitely believe, and I think you're hearing with the connectedness and the mentoring, that students need some sort of personal association and they have personal emotional problems. And who's going to deal with them? Because everyone in the school buildings has their own job, and so who's going to take care of the emotional problems that all students have to some degree? I mean, we deal with things such as my pet died this morning, or I left my homework at home, to, you know, I want to die, I'm going to commit suicide. That's the range of emotions that students have. And if you don't have school counselors there, who's going to take care of that? And so the first program that I want to show you that the slide is talking about is called SOAR, and it's in a local, it's a suburb, junior high, but it also involves students. In order to be eligible for this program, they have to be on pre-introduced lunch, so we're talking about the at-risk students, but they also are going to, they have to be, their names have to be submitted by teachers who say that they have some academic potential. And so the SOAR stands for Students on Academic Rise. And so the whole thing is geared toward helping students become successful academically. And so we are, as school counselors, as a school counseling program, trying to attack that achievement gap and try to help students become better academically, as well as maybe a more well-rounded student. And so this particular after-school program, and I know that Dr. McComas talked about after-school programs have been somewhat unsuccessful because of lack of expertise and lack of attendance, and that's one of the things this after-school program decided to really work for, and that is that they employ teachers who have the expertise, and the students are given the choice to be in the program or not, but once they agree to be in the program, then they must attend. So there's an attendance requirement, and the families are very, very much involved because the teachers are in constant contact. And then we've done the research. We do the surveys of parents, of teachers, of the students themselves to see how they, what button do I push? There we go. I'm sorry. I forgot that I was supposed to be doing this as well. And so we did all the surveys, and we looked certainly at the statistics. The three things that we've realized that we can show that we are effective, that we can be effective with our programs, is through academics, their GPA, with attendance, and with their behavior. Okay, and so those are things that we can measure and say, you know, we've been in the program, and because of this, these things have become better. Okay, and this was the GPA, and I want to tell you that this program, where we took students after school, and the ratio was very small. We had a teacher to every four or five students, and just as Dr. Johnson was saying, we've got to keep the numbers small if it's going to be effective. They raised, in one quarter, they raised their GPA an entire point, which is fantastic for these students who are struggling to even be interested in school, and who are struggling even to get to school, and who are struggling, not that they don't have transportation, but they don't have the incentive, they don't have the motivation. And so, we also looked at their the absences that they had before SOAR and after SOAR, and how they became so wanting to be in school, and it was a great increase or decrease, how you look at it, of days missed in school. And so that was another thing that showed us that they were very, very much more interested in school. We also took a look at even the tardy times in school, showing another great decrease or increase, no matter whichever way you look at it. But they became very attentive to being in class. And we also included the leadership program as part of this after-school program, looking at their social skills and their leadership skills. And that's what the school council was mostly involved in, doing activities to help these children. And so they became very, very impressed with themselves as being leaders in the school, as being role models in the school for other students who were struggling with these kinds of things. And so their attendance, their tardies, all of that improved a great deal. As I say, we're very involved with the parents as well, and so we do surveys with the parents before and after SOAR as far as what do they think about their children in the program. And all of it was very, very positive. Parents were seeing a difference in behavior. Parents were seeing a difference in attitude. Parents were seeing a difference in motivation. And so that told us that our program was really working well for them. They evaluated their children, like I say, both in attendance and in behaviors and attitudes, and even at home, became better students, better behaved children, that kind of thing. The students themselves felt so much better about themselves and about, you know, the largest one there is that teachers are more helpful. Well, part of the reason for that is that the students became better behaved, they became more willing to ask questions, they became better about turning their homework in, and so obviously the teachers responded in kind. And so it worked well for both sides, the teachers and the students. They also felt better about themselves and about the fact that they were receiving more respect and thinking of themselves as better students. So they began to see themselves as being successful academically, which was fantastic in that then they began to see themselves as possibility of going to college, of possibility of training after, a post-high school training of some sort, being able to look at a career for themselves as a real possibility instead of something far off that nobody in their families probably have ever achieved before.
Exactly. So I'm going to let you know we have about 4 minutes for your segment. Representative Tilbury is dying to ask a question.
Okay, but I'm desperate also to tell Tilbury something. I also did one in Minneapolis, working with school counselors in schools that had never had them before. And so we realized that relationship is so important. And as I said, if the school counselors aren't there, who's going to do it? Because administrators have their own jobs to do, teachers have their own jobs to do. There are quasi-administrators, vice principals, deans, whomever, that may also be in the schools, but they don't have the training that school counselors do. And they have other duties to do. So who's going to help these students? Who's going to be the mentors for these students? Who's going to be the people that are going to be able to give them the time and the expertise to help them emotionally and psychologically and just health-wise? Okay, I'll stop.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Tilbury.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a question to ask. Dr. Wall, there's been some ideas of lessening mandates out in our schools to help in these budget crises, to give schools more flexibility and so on. And they provided us with a lot of lists of mandates that they'd like to see maybe removed if possible. And some particular schools have used some things where they've combined positions, like they've had associate principals, and you'd mentioned administrators in the building and so on, mm-hmm. to handle these counseling duties. I guess I would like to know your opinion of that strategy that some of the schools are adopting.
Dr. Wall.
Madam Chair and Representative, my blood pressure just went up. I think in answer to that, I would like to challenge all of you to think about your own jobs other than being representatives and what you would think about people coming in and trying to do your job without the training for your job. Because basically that's what it amounts to, is school counselors are trained. We go through an entire master's counseling training program. So we are trained to do counseling. We are not trained to do discipline work in schools, which is much of what the administrators and the deans would be doing. And they are not trained to do counseling. They are not trained to treat these emotional problems. Like I said, students who are coming into school crying because I've lost a pet, or my parents are getting divorced, I don't think life is worth living. That whole spectrum. And you might think, well, you can refer those out to your community counselors, you know. We have also found that 70% of the referrals that we make as school counselors they don't go because of financial conditions and because of the stigma of going to counseling, whereas it's not such a stigma in school. And not that we can do family counseling or anything like that, but we can certainly address those issues in a school day with the training that we have, where, as far as I know about the dean positions that are open right now, there are no qualifications. So a teacher could be a dean, a teacher could be on extended assignment and be a principal's assistant, those kinds of things. Principals, you don't even have to have a degree sometimes to be hired in those positions, and so that scares me. It scares me for the kind of help that students would be given.
Thank you very, very much. And unfortunately, we have to go on to the fourth one, and that is fortunate, but we just don't seem to have enough time for any one person
maybe
to answer.
All
our
thank
questions.
You, Representative.
Thank you. And then we have one final person, and we do close this right at 4:15 because legislators have often appointments in their office right at 4:15.
I'd like to ask Dr. Sergei to board, and he will be brief. He promised.
Okay. Welcome, Dr. Is it Dr. Ye?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Please restate your name and title for the tape.
Stuart Ye. I'm an associate professor of Agriculture and Studies at the University of Minnesota. Today I'd like to talk about an approach for raising student achievement that I call rapid assessment. This approach involves testing students between 2 and 5 times per week in math and reading, and it provides performance feedback to students and teachers. The first step is that all of the books in a school's library are leveled. What that means is that all of the books are labeled and shelved according to reading difficulty level, so that when students walk into the school's library, they can go directly to the set of books which are at the appropriate level. Students then select a book based on their reading interests. They read the book, then they sit down at the classroom computer to take a comprehension quiz. In math, students receive individualized printed sets of problems. They complete the problems inside the classroom. They fill out bubble sheets and use a device inside the classroom to score their answers. So the system imposes a fairly small burden on teachers in terms of students scoring their own bubble sheets. The software scores the assessments, and then reports are available to teachers and administrators electronically. Three large meta-analyses have been conducted regarding the effectiveness of this approach. And the effect size for this is 0.7 standard deviations. So that's a fairly large effect size. In addition, three randomized experiments have been conducted, along with one national quasi-experimental study. And the effect size in these four studies averaged 0.3 standard deviations. If we divide that effect size by the annual cost per student, what we get is an effectiveness cost ratio. If we then perform the same exercise with a range of alternative approaches for raising student achievement, we can then compare all of these approaches. And what we see is that rapid assessment is substantially more cost effective than these other interventions. So, for example, rapid assessment is over 2,400 times as cost-effective as voucher programs. I've published multiple papers comparing rapid assessment with charter schools, a 10% increase in expenditure, high-stakes testing, comprehensive school reform, teacher certification, the use of value-added teacher assessments to identify high-performing teachers, class size reduction, imposing a minimum SAT score of 1,000 on new teacher applicants, and high-quality preschool. I think it's important to take a minute to explain why it is that the current structure of schooling creates a need for an intervention such as rapid assessment. Currently, students are placed in age group cohorts. They receive test and grade reports that continually reinforce the message that half of them are below average. So the experience of schooling for these students is that they receive daily reminders that they are not up to par, that their efforts are not producing success. And this produces a syndrome that we call learned helplessness. However, we know that an effective treatment for learned helplessness is to individualize task difficulty and performance expectations for each student so that students achieve success on a regular basis. So what rapid assessment does is it restructures the experience of schooling. Instruction is individualized, students are challenged at their own levels, and they receive objective information confirming that they are successfully advancing to higher levels. And in research that I've conducted, this appears to foster pride and excitement in academic success. Okay. I'll end my comments there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yeh. Some provocative statements. I'm sure if members have questions.
Well, I was just going to point out, this can't possibly be true, because what you're saying is we could teach kids more while spending less money, and that just can't, that can't possibly exist. So, no, very interesting, and I'd actually, if you have a chance, I'd like to talk to you after the committee meeting if you have some free time. Be happy to.
Representative Grackwo, let us hear one of your questions.
Madam Chair and Doctor, on the relative advantage of rapid assessment, you mentioned in the current experience of schooling, quote, students placed in age cohorts, grades, and test reports continually reinforce the message that half are below average. Isn't that a true statement? Aren't half of kids below average? And at some point, once these students need to acknowledge this, whether it's in the real world or the academic setting, and how would you, I guess in a real world, that's how it is. How would insulating kids from the real world help them?
Dr. Yeh.
Madam Chair, Representative Grapple. We have summative assessments. We still have the annual state mandated test, which informs teachers, administrators, parents, students, where they stand on an objective basis. What we're talking about, though, is the need on a daily basis for information for students and teachers that is not demoralizing for them, that provides information about how much progress they're making compared, so that each student is compared to his or her own previous progress. So it's that type of information that I think what the research suggests is so important in fostering student engagement and persistence. And we want to make sure that we don't undermine that persistence in our attempt to assess students objectively.
Representative Grackwo, then Representative Dietrich, and Representative Swales.
Madam Chair and Doctor, so it would be a matter of constructive criticism versus just negativity.
Dr. Yeh.
Thank you. Precisely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is do you also have counselors and mentors in this program?
Dr. Yeh.
Madam Chair, Representative, this program does not include mentors. I'm curious to know why you ask.
Let's have an answer out of a legislator first.
Because it just seems like mentors are very effective with certain groups of people, so I'm wondering what other type of support do these students have that makes them so much more cost-effective to educate?
Well, teachers provide tutoring and small group instruction inside the classroom based on the results that they get from the rapid assessment information. So in terms of mentoring students, teaching students, that job still resides with the teacher. So this program does not replace the teacher. What it does is it provides information that's useful to teachers in identifying students who need help and areas where they need help. So that when the teacher walks in the morning and flips on the computer, he or she can see a roster of students, and they are flagged in terms of the students that are having difficulty. And the teacher can identify which students, for example, are having trouble with decimals, and group those students together and do some effective small group instruction with them.
Representative Wales, and then Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I am interested in the data you have here that says high-stakes testing, would be 57 times more effective than high-stakes testing. Has this data changed your perception of all of the high-stakes tests and the battery of tests that we force our children to take?
Dr. Yeh.
Madam Chair, Representative Wales, has it changed my view? I think my view was the same before I did this research. My view was that high-stakes testing by itself is not an effective approach for raising student achievement, and it's certainly not cost-effective. It actually turns out to be highly cost-effective, and I believe each of you have a copy of the paper that provides the backup for that.
Yeah. We can provide.
Okay.
Okay.
It will be provided.
That's another budgetary decision where we could use that paper, because we do know that we're spending a lot of money on testing in our current budget. Representative Detmer, and then Representative Mariani. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Yu, have you, is there examples of schools that are currently using the rapid assessment?
Dr. Yu.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Over 60,000 schools across the country are using some form of rapid assessment, not necessarily in every classroom, but at least one classroom in over 60,000 schools are using it. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question and just perhaps a closing quick comment. My question is for Dr. Ye. Dr. Ye, I just want to be clear about some of the questions that have been asked here, including question from my good friend, Professor Garofalo. Are you prepared to say that, so taking the extreme here, are you prepared to say, based on the analysis of this implementation of this pedagogy, that we can take students and isolate them only totally doing rapid assessment work and nothing else during their K-12 experience and experience a effective K-12 outcome?
Dr. Yates.
Not at all. Rapid assessment is administered 1 hour per day in reading, 1 hour per day in math. That's the normal, dose of reading and math that students get. The rest of the day is reserved for whatever activities would normally be taught. So it's not the case that it squeezes out the rest of the curriculum.
And Madam Chair, that makes common sense to me, and I think to most of us as well, you know, given the complexity of the human nature that we respond to. I'm not a sociologist, but I would suspect sociologists would argue that we respond well to environmental settings that are diverse and offer lots of different pedagogical approaches and interactions with other with peers and with teachers. And so, but let me just, since we're closing, let me just say very quickly, Madam Chair, I want to thank Dr. Johnson and University of Minnesota and your research efforts, and in particular, Dr. Johnson, I want to thank you for the assistance that you and your colleagues extended to us in the legislature over the course of the last 2 years as we wrestled with looking at multiple assessments and attempting to incorporate them in our school report card as complementary, not replacement to our summative assessment dominated system. And as you all know, we now have a growth measure, not by virtue of legislative action, because that was unfortunately vetoed by the governor, but nonetheless, we do have a growth measure as a result of continual engagement with the executive branch, and that was implemented just a month ago, and in large part guided by good objective research-based information that you and your colleagues were able to provide. And perhaps a very quick question to you, Dr. Johnson, might be whether you perceive a need for places like the University of Minnesota to be able to engage with the legislature, not just on education practices of research, but on research relative to the policy decisions that we need, to education policy decisions that we're called to make.
Nicely said, Representative Mariani. Before I give Dr. Johnson the last word, and I'm sure all of the committee wants to ditto Representative Mariani's words and thank you, I also want to let members know Representative John Ward is having his surgery today. I said on Monday.
Sorry about that.
Better get over there quick,
he's,
John.
His heart is fine.
How are you feeling?
Representative Benson is having open heart surgery today. And so if anyone didn't plan his card, is why I was bringing this up. Here it is after the meeting, and Dr. Johnson and all the talented professors that you brought with us, thank you very much, and you get to close the meeting.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Browning. Just to touch on the question that was posed here from Representative Mariani, absolutely. I think that, you know, I mean, I don't want to be corny, but the university is a state's investment in research, in teaching, and in engagement. Probably engagement becomes even more important. The processes and strategies for engagement, how we interact and interface is beyond, I am amazed every day I go to work at the University of Minnesota for what it holds and what it is in terms of the capacity that exists, the talents, the expertise that I can't even tap into being there to even support my own work. I'm amazed that there are people doing common kinds of research that I am involved in from colleges and departments across the university that I still have not the time to get a hold of and meet with. So, yeah, I guess a simple answer, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity as well.
Thank you. And the meeting's adjourned.